and waited behind the Sakarya River. Not a very wide river, but enough to form a bit of an obstacle. He was about 250,000 strong. By the time the Greeks got there, they had very small forces indeed. He put about 5,000 troops across onto the Greek side of the river with instructions that they were to offer token resistance. And at a given point, they were to bolt and rush back over the bridge and go on running so the Greeks could chase after them. This in due course happened. The Greeks chased after them over the bridge, and there were 250,000 Turks all dug in waiting for them. What had taken the Greeks 18 months to capture or to occupy, the Turks got the whole lot back in about 10 days. They chased the Greeks all the way to Smyrna. And of course they had all the Greek dumps in different places to feed them. And of course the native population was all on their side. The Greek generals had never taken that into consideration. They had stretched that bit of elastic till it got to breaking point, all in enemy territory. The people keeping Mustafa Kemal informed of all the Greeks' doings and comings and goings, and the Greeks on their side not knowing anything that Mustafa Kemal was doing. Anyhow, the Turks chased the Greeks all the way down to Smyrna. In Smyrna, then everybody bolted who had anything to do with the government. Police, army, fire brigade, postal services, everybody bolted. Allied and foreign ships came into Smyrna by the hundreds to take people out. Big British men of war, battle cruisers, battleships came in as well. And most of the foreigners were taken off. Of the Greek-speaking population, many escaped, but of course a lot had to stay there. Couldn't all get away. And after a bit, the fire of Smyrna broke out. My brother Francis and his wife Katie and their newborn babe John went on board one of the British merchantmen. And the next 5 or 10 minutes, I must really describe what happened from our family point of view and the way the British behaved. Francis and Katie were on the stern of the ship, tied, moored to the quayside. One of Katie's friends, Gladys Routh, who was the secretary of the British consul, came down to the quay and called out to Katie, "Katie, what have you got with you? What clothes and things have you got?" Katie called back, just what I'm standing up in and nothing else at all. Gladys Routh took off her coat, made a bundle of it, threw it up to Katie. She took off her dress, made a bundle of it, threw it up to Katie. She took off her shoes and threw them up to Katie. And she had to walk back to the consulate in her underclothes and without her shoes. I'm glad to say that Gladys Routh later was given an OBE. The other British population in Smyrna had all been warned by the consulate to be ready to evacuate. And here again, the British knack of knowing how to do things and organizing things came into play. And as far as we were concerned, Bujar was 5 miles from Smyrna. My father lived in a company house next to the station. There was no telephone service. The only communication was by the railway telegraph. So the consulate asked my father to be the consular representative in Bujar. And instructions could be sent by the railway telegraph to my father, who lived right alongside the station. In due course, instructions were sent to my father, tell all the Britishers in Bujar to leave within the next 36 hours, ship waiting for them in the harbor. Now, father had the job of walking on his flat feet, of course, to all these various English houses. Bujar was a big town, or a big village, and there were 11 or 12,000 inhabitants. And he told me about this afterwards. He went from house to house, telling the people what the consulate had said, what their instructions were. And he also had to go and see a very elderly gentleman and his wife, a Mr. and Mrs. Bath, who lived the other end of the village. And father described it to me this way. He said, "If ever I was scared, it was this time. Shooting was going on right and left all over the place. And I had to walk past the Konak, which is the gendarmerie, little barracks. And there were Turkish soldiers sitting just outside these barracks, all trigger happy, with their rifles on their knees, no one visible anywhere, and I had to walk past them. That was all right as long as I was facing them. But then I had about 200 yards to walk uphill towards the Bath's house, within sight of these soldiers. All of them, of course, down from the mountains, they didn't know an Englishman from a Chinaman. And I anyhow had no means of identifying myself as being a Britisher. I daren't run, for I knew if I ran, they'd shoot. So I walked steadily, as fast as I thought was safe, and I went to the Baths and told them what the consulate instructions were. And he said, what do you think? They said, oh, we're not going to take any notes of the consulate. Oh, we're not going to leave, we're going to stay here. We like the Turks, quite good enough for us, we'll stay here. I said, then I had a job of walking all the way back again. This time not quite so bad, because I was facing the gendarmes, the soldiers, at this gendarmerie little barracks place. I walked past them, right along past the English church and the churchyard, quite a long straight road. And then, out of a doorway, stepped out Mr. Bourdelakis. Now I must explain that Bourdelakis was a Greek. He was the chief smuggler of tobacco in the Smyrna district. He was known as such. And Bourdelakis, of course, as a smuggler, although he'd made a lot of money, he was a wealthy man, he was looked down upon, naturally, by all the decent folk, and certainly by all the British. And Bourdelakis stepped out, and he said, excuse me, Mr. Holton, but Mr. and Mrs. de Jong, there's some Dutch people who were treated as really as English people, who always came to our church and so on, Mr. and Mrs. de Jong have been shot dead and are lying just at the entrance of their house. So I went back with him, and he took one and I took the other on our backs, dead, and we carried them to the churchyard, the English Protestant churchyard, that I had passed coming back from the baths. We shut the door and laid them on the ground amongst the other graves. And I then had an idea, because next to the English church and the churchyard was a high wall. The other side of the high wall was a Franciscan monastery. And I said to Brother Lakis, you find some form of implement, a fork, a spade, or anything you can, and dig a shallow grave. I'm going over the wall to the monastery. Father clambered over the wall, the monastery, and after some time came back again over the wall with the Franciscan monk. Now, to all those who feel that religion and differences of religion are so important, Father came back with a Franciscan monk. Bourdelakis was a Greek Orthodox man, if he had any religion at all. He dug the grave. Father came back with the monk, a Roman Catholic. The monk said prayers and read the burial service in the Roman Catholic fashion. The other two present, one was a hard-bitten British Anglican Protestant businessman, and the other was a smuggler, Greek Orthodox. And in the presence of death, and for the last rites, these three so different persons were united. After the war, I once said something to Father about Bourdelakis, and he insisted that I call him Mr. Bourdelakis. He's a gentleman, whatever else he is. Well, Father and Mother stayed at home for another day, and then Father decided, as I said before, De Candolle, the general manager, he'd bolted. Father decided that he and Mother should go down to town, into Smyrna, and they went to the general manager's house alongside the railway station, informed the consulate. All the other Britishers had gone. Mother and Father were the last to leave. And the consulate told them to stay there until such time as somebody came to fetch them, but not to go to bed at night, to just sit in comfortable chairs and sleep in comfortable chairs with their bags packed. And the second night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, knock at the door, a British naval officer with about 20 men, sailors, told Father and Mother to follow them. They walked in the middle, flanked by about 10 British sailors on each side, and this officer in the front, and the sailors carrying their bags. They went to the nearest point on the quay, where British pinnace from HMS Iron Duke was waiting. They got on the Iron Duke, and from there they went to Malta. Amongst the things that happened in Smyrna, Mother described how coming down from Bujao to Smyrna in the train, everything was upside down, everybody was distraught. There was a Greek woman in the carriage with a baby in one arm and a parcel in the other. Halfway down Smyrna, the poor dear was so distraught she decided to throw out the parcel, concentrate on just carrying the baby. But she was so distraught she threw the baby out of the window and held on to the parcel till she found out what she had done, and then just shrieked. On the funnier side of things, however, Father also described what he saw. A Greek soldier being chased by a Turkish soldier. The Greek soldier was riding a donkey, and the Turkish soldier was riding a little pony. They were 200 or 300 yards away from each other, and they were chasing each other on the quay. And the Turkish soldier was trying to fire his rifle whilst riding this pony. Of course, not getting anywhere, hitting anything, the ground or anything else, not within yards of the Greek who was running away on the donkey. And the Greek looked round and saw the Turk was rather gaining on him. So he saw a little rowing boat tied to the quayside. He pulled up his donkey, jumped off, jumped into this rowing boat, put the oars out and started rowing like hell for the nearest ship. By the time the Turk got to the spot, jumped off his horse and went on shooting at this Greek. The Greek had rowed quite a few yards, perhaps 100 or 200. The Turk, of course, was absolutely out of breath, and his rifle shaking all over the place, and his bullets were going yards away from the boat that the Greek was in. Well, that's that. In the meantime, of course, the town of Smyrna was burning. And Father did So you have what an awesome sight it was that evening as the Iron Duke went off towards Malta. And he looked back and saw the whole town from one end to the other in one huge blaze of fire. Now one has said, and I, as I did, to my father, who burnt Smyrna? How did it burn? Was it the Turks or was it the Greeks? And father, of course, gave me the absolutely right answer. The Greeks, oh no, said the Greeks wouldn't burn Smyrna. They were too damn keen to get out as quick as they could to save their skins, so they couldn't stop to burn anything. So I said, well then the Turks. He said, no, of course not. Why should the Turks burn Smyrna? That's what they've been fighting for. This was the jewel that they'd recaptured. They weren't going to recapture that jewel and then chuck it away by burning it. No, no. Said, this is what happened. Undoubtedly. The fire brigade had all bolted. The police had all bolted. Everybody had bolted. But there's no doubt that in the Armenian quarter, which is one of the poorest quarters of Smyrna, there must have been plenty of bad characters who thought this was a good opportunity to pay back old scores, to murder or to loot or do anything. So he said, undoubtedly, there's quite a lot of paying back of old scores in that quarter. And to cover their tracks, they would upset an oil lamp and set fire to whatever there was there. A lot of those houses were built of wood. No fire brigade. Every afternoon the imbat blew. That's a special wind which you get in the Levant in the summertime or in the springtime. Every afternoon. And that spread the flames. Without any fire brigade or police to do anything about it, it just spread and spread and spread until the whole of Smyrna was burned down. Her father went to Malta, and all the railway people also had been taken to Malta, where the British government had organized hotels to put all these Britishers up. And that was that. They had to wait there till they could get back again to Smyrna. From Malta, father came over to London to see the board of directors and to report, because, as I say, Deccan Dole had bolted. And in due course, father was sent back as general manager. And to hell with having civil engineers or any special person to run the railway. As the board told my father, we want somebody who knows the Turks and somebody who knows the country and somebody who knows the railway and somebody who's loyal to the company. And father was appointed general manager. Now that's as far as that is concerned. But one or two things must be said. After all this, the Allies who had sent the Greeks to Smyrna decided to look into the matter once again. So they didn't drive out the Turks from Smyrna. But there were some 500,000 Greeks in Turkey and some 500,000 Turks in Greece, particularly in Thrace, north of Salonika, and between Salonika and Constantinople. So all these clever politicians, Mr. Lloyd George, Mr. Poincaré, Mr. Wilson of America, sitting on their backsides in Paris, decided that the best thing to do would be to take all the Greeks from Turkey and send them to Greece, and all the Turks from Greece and send them to Turkey. 500,000 lives in each case, about 1 million people, to be just taken up, uprooted, and sent to another country. Most of them would have been farmers who knew their conditions and their crops and their weather and their markets, to be taken up and to sent to another country where they wouldn't know either markets, weather, crops, or methods of tilling the ground. So came the greatest scandal of all, when 1 million people were uprooted and sent from one country to another. The Turks arriving from Greece in Turkey were regarded with great suspicion by the Turks. The Greeks who came to Greece from Turkey were called Turkish dogs by the Greeks. And nothing was done to rehabilitate them or to house them. I know for a fact that 7 or 8 years later, I was in the Swiss Bank in London, and Father would come to me and say, "I want you to write a letter for me in Greek to the wife of Athanasis." Athanasis was a man that we used to employ in our vineyard in Bujar. Father knew he was dead, or was pretty certain of it, but his wife didn't know it. Father didn't want to tell her that, but he used to send her a little money, not much, £5, £6 or something like that, each time, every 2 or 3 months. And then a letter from written by me for my father, asking her how she was and how the family was, whether she'd had any news from Athanasis, which of course we knew she wouldn't have had, and really trying to help in any way we can. So you see, the Greeks had done nothing to help her. I think they supplied the basic necessities in food. But 5 or 6 years later, she and hundreds more were still sleeping on the floor of a school in Athens. I always feel that there's a special little place in hell for politicians who interfere in the affairs of people outside their own country, knowing nothing about the conditions, trying to what they think is make things better, instead of which they make them worse, and the conditions having been created by their own folly a year or two before. But to carry on, I think, with Father here, I better do this to get that part of it sorted out. Father went back to Smyrna as general manager. He got things going once again. The old staff came back, and there's quite a lot of new recruitment to be done, of new drivers and guards and station masters and all that sort of thing, because all the Greek element had gone. And when things were running reasonably well, Father came back to London, saw the board, and said to them something after this: I have had to run for my life with my wife and family on two occasions, in 1914 and 1921. I have gone back two or three times and restarted the railway. I have done so again now. The railway is running, and I think it's time that you found another general manager, as I think it's time that I should retire. After all, I am about 60. I think his age is about 60. And I think I don't want to have to start again building up a home and everything else in Smyrna. The directors agreed and said, my father, that's all right, Houghton, but who are we going to get to take your place? We've had enough of these people like de Candolle and people like that. And we realize now how wrong we were in picking our managers in the past. So we want your suggestion. Father said, there's only one man who can do it.